It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and I'm speaking to you from Seldovia, Alaska, on the south side of Kachemak Bay. It's a beautiful day, and I'm out here with Aaron McKittrick, who is a pretty well-known author and adventurer, at her home, which is a yurt up on the hill above Seldovia and above the bay. And Aaron has just published a book about her journey around Cook Inlet. She took her kids and her husband Hig, and they traveled up one side of the inlet and down the other on foot. A really, really long, amazing journey that I'd never heard of anyone else doing. And when they got back, she wrote a book about where they'd been, what their adventures were like, and it's a really interesting day by day, mile by mile log, and also an exploration of the history of the inlet and what it's like out there. And for those of us who lived around this inlet all of our lives, it's kind of funny to think that not many of us have been really around all sides of it. So it's a treat to be here in Aaron's garden while she's weeding her, are you weeding?
Chickweed.
Yeah. I can see you're removing chickweed, but I don't know what's supposed to be.
There's actually carrots supposed to be here, but you can hardly see them because of all the chickweed that I'm
They're just getting started, yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us about your book and how you came to write it. Did you, first of all, the title and the publisher and all that stuff, but did you decide to write it before you took the expedition, or did the idea come to you as you're out there?
I decided to do it before. The book is called Mud Flats and Fish Camps, 800 Miles Around Alaska's Cook Inlet, and I wanted to do it because, well, I like having adventures, of course, so that's part of it, but I've always found it fascinating. I mean, I live on Cook Inlet. Like, right now, I'm looking, if I stand up mm-hmm. and can see over the salmon berries, I can see, you know, the west side of Cook Inlet. I can see the volcanoes over there.
You kind of wonder, like, what's over there, right?
And It's the diversity that drew me, actually, because Cook Inlet, over there on the west side by Mount Illiamna, total remote wilderness. And there's a lot of total remote wilderness in Alaska, but Cook Inlet is unique, I think, because it has both. It has total remote wilderness, and it has Anchorage, and it has the Russian Old Believer communities, and it has fish camps, and it has bear viewing lodges, and it has, you know, our little town, and it has Tyonek, and it has Soldotna, and it has just so many interesting different parts of Alaska come together around this one water body, and I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, and so sort of the idea of an adventure and of a book kind of come together in a way, because you got to do the adventure to do the book.
Well, yeah, because I guess, and you know, I've run into this sometimes on being interviewed, is that, you know, if you're doing an adventure, people sometimes want you to have a soundbite, like, you're doing it to raise awareness of this or that. I'm like, well, I guess I'm doing it to raise my own awareness, right? Because if I thought I knew the answer, if I thought I knew what I should be telling you all to think, then why the heck would I be needing to walk around the whole inlet and see things and talk to people? And so, you know, I guess I'm selfish. I want to learn. I want to see. I wanted to meet people. And one thing we did on this trip is that we met people, like we always do, but then we also asked them all about what they thought the future of this area was going to be. And it was so many fascinating conversations.
Oh, I'm sure. I would, you know, on first thought, I would think that doing this trek would be a super challenging trek, because there's a lot of places where you'd have to paddle. There's a lot of places where it's muddy or where the shore is really steep. So for an experienced outdoors person, it would be challenging. And then you also took children along. Did you think of it as a challenging thing before you started? Do you have any doubts, or were you just sort of like totally confident from the beginning?
Oh, there's always doubts, right? Uh-huh. I mean, you know, if you're not like thinking about contingencies, then you're not really doing a good job of planning.
Right.
But, you know, I guess I'd already sort of learned that, you know, I don't put too much stock in what other people think is impossible. I just, you know, make my own plan and we'll see. And there were a lot of unknowns. Like we had our son was 4 at the time, so he was too big to be carried. He was going to walk all of the walking parts on his own. And did we know quite how that would work? No, we had no idea.
800 miles for a 4-year-old, right?
Yeah. And, you know, a few hundred, right, because we paddled some. Yeah. But, yeah, no, we don't know. Like, really, how far does a 4-year-old walk in a day once they get in the groove? And didn't know that. And, you know, mud flats, like that's the mud is the first word in the title and the photo on the cover. And actually those areas up by like the Susitna Delta, Turnagain Arm, like with quicksand and huge mud flats were some of the biggest obstacles mm-hmm. of the whole trip.
Absolutely, yeah.
And there was a lot we didn't know.
Well, let's get into that because, I mean, I've been out there on those mud flats out by Susitna boating and just trying to get out of a boat, getting to shore safely with a tide that can come in so rapidly. And also when the waves are, you can hear the kids in the background. We're playing in front of Aaron McKittrick's house. And like when you get a good strong south wind, you can get some serious waves rolling over those mud flats and hard to get away from.
Yeah, and so, of course, part of that is choosing your weather, but part of that is also you're out in the pack raft there, and you really kind of have to treat yourself as, I don't know if it's flotsam or jetsam, but, like, as basically something going with the current. Like, the Susitna, you know, you just have to go out with the tide. You basically have to embrace this, and you know, we were at one point, I think, according to the map, we were, like, in the middle of the inlet, right? Because you're just being shot miles out that river delta.
They're having some races with a bicycle and yes. a plastic cart. Yeah.
But, yeah, and so you just do that. And then, like, as the tide's dropping, you're just out on a sandbar, you know. They take a lunch break, and then the tide starts rising again, and you follow it back. And in that whole time, like, I think you can even look at our track line. It looks like this, you know, series of waves because you go way out and then way in, and you're just trying in the course of that to get a little bit in the direction uh-huh. you're going.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. Like, you go out one channel, and you got to try to find the next one as you go in, and then you have to go all the way up above the tide line. Of course, you can't find a spot to camp, and yeah. then you just... You know, that is how you have to cross those things. And
that could take a long time during which weather would change, I would think.
It could. I mean, basically, you're not going to... And it's basically, especially when the tide is high and it's all full, that you're really mm-hmm. worried about that. And so yeah. you're paying attention. And so high tide is when you're going to be closest to the land and you don't go out if it mm-hmm. looks bad. And there were certainly... times when we couldn't raft, and there were times when we were like wading through ankle deep water, like barefoot on the mud for like miles because there was too choppy. And so, but in the ankle deep water, we could kind of tow the pack rafts, like they could kind of float on that little cushion uh-huh. so we could put the gear in it and the kids in it and go squelch, 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 and like walk, you know, miles in some cases on uh-huh. and just through ankle deep water with when it was all choppy.
Yeah, and this is kind of like something that I've never heard of anybody actually doing, of crossing the, like that big, huge Susitna Delta area kind of on foot. I mean, you hear lots of people go out fishing and go hunting and go up there, but to do it human-powered is kind of unique.
Well, unique in modern times, right? Mm-hmm. Because... You haven't heard of people that you know, like, in the last few years doing it, but if you're starting to look back decades or hundreds of years, I mean, people did that all the time. People in Tyonek were telling us, oh, yeah, you know, I think it took them just, like, hours to get to potlucks in Anchorage when they knew exactly where to go mm-hmm. and exactly how to time the currents. And so it's maybe more of a... forgotten skill than a new one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm so interested in hearing about your research, where you found all that stuff out. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. I'm in Seldovia and talking with Erin McKittrick about her new book, which recounts a journey all the way around Cook Inlet, with your husband, Hig, and your kids, four-year-old on foot, and a kid being carried, too, right?
Yeah. My daughter was 2.5 at the time, and so she would, you know, walk occasional little bits, but not reliably over any significant distance. So she was a pack.
Uh-huh.
And I packed her, and Hig packed most of our stuff, and like I had like a little fanny pack and something hanging off my chest where I tried to stuff as much weight as I could manage while still having the kid on my back.
Yeah, it's pretty tiring walking a beach, isn't it? I mean, because it's not like hard surface like on a trail. I mean, your feet sort of sink in and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You're not big for complaining, I realize. But.
I don't know. I mean, you're comparing it to a trail. And uh-huh. I was sitting there thinking, I'm comparing it to, like, you know, just looking out into the brush, like what I'm looking at right now. I'm like, no, the beach is easy. I mean, you're not, you don't have any devil's club. You're not like clambering through the alder. I mean, on the scale of wilderness, beaches are easy.
Yeah. Tell me about the research process before going out and doing this. Did you do some reading about the sort of the history and the people of Cook Inlet?
I did some, and then I did more afterwards. Like I did, you know, I can't necessarily remember what parts I did before and what parts I did afterwards, but I did things like I audited Alan Boris's Cook Inlet Anthropology, I think it's called. He has a course that you can take online. So there's a lot of great material about the Dena'ina from that. And then you can, through the magic of the internet, you can get like all of the explorers' logs are not copyright protected and you can download those. And so I read a lot of those too and just other things I found. And
what were some of the main things that you discovered that were that you didn't expect or that most people don't think about Cook Inlet?
Oh, it's a good question. I think that you know, there's really, I think in a way there's been a lot of, you know, more concentration of, you know, people. Anchorage is so huge, but you know, there were so many, you know, there were actually people out in all parts of the inlet, you know, more so than now. Like there's a lot of parts of it that are actually less populated and more wild than they used to be because there were more native villages and more little fox farms and more this, that, and the other thing. And so there's actually more history than I would have thought for places that are pretty wild now.
Yeah, I think that's true. There's some depopulations taking place. Like I'm kind of familiar with Point McKenzie, which is right across from Anchorage. And in the 1950s, I think there's a real homesteading community there with different people who are proving up their homesteads and stuff. You go out there now, it's not too many people around.
Yeah, and also just, you know, how, you know, almost how recent and how almost just kind of happenstance, you know, having Anchorage there in the first place is that, you know, it's just, there's so many just accidents of history, and we might not have even had any big cities on Cook Inlet. Like, it's not really a very good place for one.
Yeah.
And, like, the fact that most of Alaska's population is, you know, right here and can look out on this is kind of weird.
Uh-huh. It is, yeah. And how did that feel coming into Anchorage? Because one thing I've noticed is, as you approach Anchorage, and if you're on the water, it kind of is not that noticeable, especially north of Anchorage, coming up to Eagle River and Eagle River Flats. It looks an awful lot like Alaska out there.
Yeah, and we actually, you know, we were coming from the south, and we did come into the city, and we were staying with people, so we came right onto the streets and things. But, yeah, it's partly it doesn't look noticeable from the water because I kind of feel like a lot of people in Anchorage don't even notice there's water there. I mean, try to find the harbor in Anchorage. Like, try to ask people where the small boat harbor is, and most of them don't know, which would be, you know, coming from a place like Seldovia, you can't imagine people, like, the harbor's the center of the town. Everybody knows where the harbor is. You couldn't miss it.
Right. And ask Anchorage people where the airport is. They would know that.
They're going to know where the airport is. They're going to ask them where the highway is. They know where the airport is. They know where the highway is.
Yeah, which would be the equivalent in Seldovia, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, so that transition from really rural to really urban, was that part of what you were looking for in this exploration, seeing what those two kinds of world were like?
Yeah, looking both in what those worlds were like, and also the attitudes. It was interesting because you ask people, you know, what they think about the future, and you know, where they are really influences what they're going to say. So in other parts of Cook Inlet, people were, I don't know, they were as likely to be worried about things declining as they were to be worried about things growing. Like, you heard both. Mm-hmm. But in Anchorage, because it's just seen so much rapid growth compared to everywhere else, like, everybody just assumed that that growth was going to continue, that Anchorage was just going to keep growing and booming and growing and booming. And that wasn't the same attitude I got in other places. Now, I don't know who's right, but it was just an interesting difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So people from within Anchorage just maybe have a different conception of what Alaska is all about.
Or, I mean, saying what Alaska is all about maybe implies that, well, of course, you know, probably somebody's right, but implies somebody's right in a way that we should mm-hmm. be able to figure out. But I think they're both parts of Alaska, but the surroundings of where you are and the history of where you are influences how you're going to see everything else. And it does for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever done that experiment I remember doing in college where it's like a psychology class, and they ask you to make a map of the places where you go every day, and without looking at a real map. And then when you look at it, you realize the scale is totally messed up. Places where you spend all the time are huge, and the places where you almost never go get tinier and tinier and tinier. And I wonder if we do that a little bit. If I was going to draw a map of Cook Inlet, probably Kashmak Bay would be 10 times too large, and Anchorage would be too large. And I never think about all those places on the west side. And you've actually been there and like filled in that map. And if I feel like that must have been really cool. Just getting a sense of the distances and like what it really looks like? That must have been great.
Yeah, sure. I mean, because I can look out at the west side of Cook Inlet and I can think, I walked there, and I can remember what it was like to walk there and how far it was. And there's places, like some of the most amazing wilderness I've seen is out there, like in Kamishak Bay area, which is huge, by the way, bigger than Kachemak Bay. Nobody goes out there.
Just fishermen, right?
Yeah. Of course, there's some boats that are going to be there, but even, you know, not that many compared to the boats in other areas, and certainly not that many people on land, and some of it's kind of difficult areas. There's a lot of harsh weather there. There's a lot of cliffs, but just amazing. I mean, like, there's waterfalls and caves and arches and one sea arch that we were actually kind of stuck in, and we camped there for 2 days in this like kind of rock cathedral that if it had been somewhere other than out on the Inniskin Peninsula, like, you know, people would be putting it in kayak guidebooks.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't bet hardly anybody except for the few, you know, fishermen and such out there knows it's there.
Which is nice, actually.
Yes.
So did you discover anything just about the scale of this place? I mean, when you say 800 miles, that's a really long way, right? I mean, this place is huge, isn't it?
It is. It's huge because we, you know, when we walked, you know, up to Anchorage and then down the other side. And I remember at one point, I think we were out sort of by Trading Bay, and we were at, met a fisherman, went into his cabin, and he was asking about the trip. So walked in, looking at the maps on his wall. And so I was like, okay, and we're going there and there, and then kind of off the corner of your map and, you know, down there. And he was just wowed by how far it was from his place to Cape Douglas. And it was already farther to get to where you are. It's a long way. I mean, it's a big water body. And, you know, we didn't, and that's even with the few, you know, shortcuts we took. We didn't go all the way up to the head of every bay and inlet. You can make it almost infinitely long if you do that.
Well, I noticed you kind of cut off a little bit of the end of Kachemak Bay, and then when you got up to Turning an Arm, did you cut some of that off? I mean, those are pretty treacherous waters, right?
I think we paddled across Turnigan a little bit before, like, Portage and the zoo there. So yeah, so
kind of got the most of it then.
Yeah, but we did cut off Kinnickarm. That's the one we cut off. We just paddled across from Anchorage to Point McKenzie.
Okay, so you missed it. Well, it's kind of pretty up there. So I guess I've been one place in Alaska that you haven't been. And then going down the
We did come down that. We came down some of that though when we were coming from Seattle to the Aleutians. So we've seen bits and pieces of a lot of that. We covered some of that.
So, and then on the west side, did you, did you sort of do the whole thing, or were there spots over there that you jumped over because there's just so much?
I'm trying to think. I think we paddled across, what was it, Chinitna Bay? So there's some. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, when you're out there, the calculation is...
They're not there to prove something.
No, I mean, I don't know, like... What are you going to prove? Like, be the first person to do something that's kind of crazy that nobody else wants to do? Sure, you know, you're going to get that anyway. And, you know, and because of that, it's not like you could do it the fastest and you got this four-year-old. No, it's all about the experience. And so we want to experience as much as possible. We also want to not run out of food, and we want to, you know,
be safe,
and some of that means taking advantage of the weather when it's good. So some things that we cut off, it's just like, okay, you know, today the weather is good, we can cross and get past an obstacle, and we do it. And other times it's not, and you know, we might walk around further, and it's all very fuzzy. We make a very specific plan sometimes, and we even go and try to figure out, okay, exactly how many days will it take us from here to there and from there to the next place? And then we throw it out, you know. You have to have the plan so you can not follow it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I love the way that you structured the book with these different episodes, kind of like a journal. And it's not exactly all about just stuff that happened to you. It's about what you're discovering in these places. But as a reader, you can kind of drop in and learn about different individual places. You know, you can read it straight through, and you kind of have this forward narrative or through line of the fact that you're doing it sort of step by step. Is that, it's one way of structuring your material that seems like it works really well.
Yeah, and I think in a way, you know, it's funny to say this because I did the whole walk because I wanted to, but also I feel like it let me stitch together all these really different interesting places and things about Cook Inlet, because the thing that attracted me to learning more about it really was that diversity. But to make that diversity work, you need to have something that to make that diversity work, you need to have something that can bring the reader through it. And so in a way, like, we're trudging through the mud to bring you through all these different places on Cook Inlet. And so, yeah, I have a chapter about, you know, the oil facilities and, you know, the people there that we met on the west side. And I have one in Anchorage, and I have one, you know, out by all the, you know, bears on Western Cook Inlet, and then here in Kachemak Bay. And so I kind of, and really, yeah, all those places are kind of their own story stitched together by me trudging along through the mud running into trouble in various ways.
And I want to learn more about that. We're here with Aaron McKittrick. It's an outdoor explorer. New book is Mud Flats and Fish Camps from Mountaineers Books.
Yes.
Yeah. And we're in Seldovia, and the kids you're hearing in the background are the kids who Aaron has taken on some of these amazing expeditions. And so in the second half, I want to learn a lot more about taking kids in the wilderness and how to do that, you know, safely and how to have fun, because I don't think anybody's done more of that than Aaron has. And also learn more about her thoughts about Cook Inlet. What are the threats to it, and what are the things that are right? But first, we're going to go inside because you need to bake a pie. So we'll do that, and then we'll be back outside. So stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. So what are you guys doing?
I am making rhubarb pie for a potluck tonight.
All right. That's like probably a main Seldovia form of gathering would be a potluck.
Yes, Seldovia is pretty much all about potlucks. Like, we have a big potluck culture here, and I think that just about every party, especially in the summer, is on someone's yard, deck, or a beach. Everybody brings something, have a potluck. And I'm known for my rhubarb pies and rhubarb berry pies, and so that's usually my contribution.
Did you grow this rhubarb? Obviously you did.
Yes, we did. Rhubarb, although the rhubarb kind of grows itself in Alaska, so I can't really claim a whole lot of, like, you know, hard effort to make the rhubarb grow.
So what? Go ahead, you keep working. Don't let me stop you.
Okay, I need my rolling here.
I was just looking around at the little homestead here. And do you guys grow a lot of your food?
We grow a lot. I think that saying we grow a lot of our food would be, we grow a lot of our produce. But growing a lot of our food would require being able to actually get a lot of calories from it, which is not true. But we grow all our we grow all our salad and a lot of our vegetables, especially in the summer. We usually have some carrots and beets and things to last us a bit through the winter. Uh-huh. But we buy all of our rice and noodles and all that kind of stuff.
So I was noticing that when I came in, that I was in the very first two-story yurt that I had ever been in, which is, I mean, it's a yurt, which a lot of people have seen, but then it's on top. You built it up so that there's another room underneath.
Yeah, we lived here, you know, we've lived here since before my kids were born, so about 9 years now, and it was just the regular one room at first, but because it's built on a hill, we always had space underneath, and it was just, you know, dirt floor storage space. But then we decided after, you know, a good number of years, wow, wouldn't it be nice if we could, like, put the kids to bed actually in a different room than we're hanging out in? And so we just actually jacked it up a little bit more and then closed in the underneath in a kind of octagon shape. Mm-hmm. And then we have basically three little bedrooms, is maybe a strong statement, three little bed nooks, one for each kid and one for Hig and I. And then we also have, we covered the rest of the space down there with some tumbling mats. And so we have a little mini indoor gym.
Uh-huh. So, and you're kind of up on this hill where you can see Seldovia Bay and you can see right across Kachemak Bay. I mean, it's a pretty sweet spot you've got here.
Yeah, actually, people are always coming out here when the weather's not good enough, but you can see three volcanoes. You can see one, there's Augustine, and you should be able to see Readout and Iliamna, but it depends on the cloudiness.
Yeah. So you've been writing a lot for the Dispatch. Have you been writing for a lot of other publications recently, too?
Not a lot. Bits and pieces of things here and there, and then for the Dispatch, and then you know, just working on other things.
Yeah, it seems like you have to have you're having big adventures each time you write something, so that takes a lot more effort than it takes for most writers.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know if that many writers work full-time, but I don't work full-time or pretend to. I also do adventures, I homeschool my kids, you know, I grow a garden. We're going to go out and spend a month building a trail in August. So I try to make it work.
Uh-huh.
I could probably be more productive. Everybody could probably be more productive.
What's your trail building project?
We're making a trail that we made about half of last year that goes from in Kachemak Bay State Park, and it goes from Kachemak Bay to the Kenai Fjord side.
Oh, wow.
Out into the coast that hardly anybody gets to see.
Yeah, there used to be a road where you could get over there, a Red Mountain Road, is that what it was called? And then kind of the bridges washed out or something?
Yeah, there used to be an old logging road that's mm-hmm. pretty well washed out now. And this trail route, though, is nowhere near the old road. It's in the park, uh-huh. not on native land in the clear cuts. And also, it's a place that should be relatively easy to maintain once we build it, not a place where a lot of washouts are going to happen.
Oh, cool. So where is it going to start from, and where does it end on the other side?
Tutka Bay to Taylor Bay.
Huh. I don't know about Taylor Bay.
Well,
does it go like from the head of Tutka Bay all the way up?
Head of Tutka Bay.
Okay. Huh. Well, that gets you a good deal of the way across because that's a very long fjord.
Yes. Well, that's a help, although for the water taxis, maybe not so much because it's a tide-dependent drop-off. But it's a good route. It's a neat, like the 5 miles we did last year is pretty neat. Gets you up into the Alpine. And this year, we actually got a grant to help with transportation so we can get a whole bunch of volunteers in some float planes to Taylor Bayside to the Kenai Fjords, and we can all kind of hack and flag and snip our way back up.
That sounds wonderful. I hadn't heard about that. Do you get your supplies in Anchorage? I know that, I mean, Seldovia is such a quiet little town and doesn't have much in the way of shopping. Or Homer, or how do you...
Homer is kind of our big city. So I think I do, similarly to what a lot of people do, is sort of a mix. So when somebody's going over to Homer, we line it up to make a big shopping run, order some things on Amazon Prime, and then fill in the remainder from the store here in town.
Mm-hmm.
And the store here in town, you know, they're actually, for a small town store, pretty good. They're just, but their problem is they're dependent on the ferry schedule like everybody else. And so when the ferry hasn't been running as much, which is true since the Tustamina has been under repair for a rather long time, then the store doesn't have much fresh either.
Yeah, I would think that this town would be so quiet in the wintertime that if you weren't really into kind of solitude, you would go a little bit nuts. Because, I mean, in the summertime, it's pretty quiet. In fact, like on the busiest day of the year, it's not all that busy. So, I mean, do you like that, this totally quiet sort of like feeling of like nobody around? Is that something that attracts you to being here?
I don't know. I think that people who equate small towns with solitude, that's not necessarily true. Yeah. I mean,
everybody knows your business, right?
Like, how many people, you know, even in a city, right, in Anchorage, how many people are you actually regularly interacting with? Not like driving past them, but like talking to them in a day. I bet it's not more than live here. Mm-hmm. I bet it's actually, you know, dozen, two dozen. I mean, there's not that many people that you're actually going to talk to in a day, and we have plenty of people for that. So, I mean, the things that are different about living in a small town is that, of course, if you want the solitude, you want the wilderness, it's right there. And also, if you want, you know, conveniences, like, you know, you want the store to have some vegetables, even though the ferry hasn't come in 2 weeks, well, then you're going to be out of luck. But, like, finding people to hang out with is not hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your homeschooling, is that because of a philosophy about how you want to have your kids educated? Is it because of a concern about the school? Or what's your thinking there?
I mean, pretty much the philosophy. I mean, it's... And lifestyle, both. So, really, I think that, you know, a more child-directed learning is a really good way to go. Also, that allows a lot of flexibility for us to do things that we find important, like spending time outdoors, regardless of the time of year or day of the week. And basically, it's really been a lot of fun.
And so you're able to sort of go off on these adventures and take school with you.
Yeah.
How does that work exactly? I'm turning the, like in the course of a day when you're out paddling or hiking, how do you do a school lesson?
Well, if you're thinking about official school lessons, we don't. If you think about learning, it happens all the time. A lot of learning happens through conversation. And sometimes the conversation is about like the things you would think about. Oh yeah, of course they're like learning about, you know, insects and, you know, geology because they're out wandering around in the woods. But if you're out wandering around, you have a lot of time to talk, and you can talk about politics, and you can talk about history, and you can play math games, and, you know, you can tell stories. And so I think that there's a lot that you can learn without needing to have something super formal set up.
Looks like this pie is getting fairly close.
Yes, it is. Just a couple more pieces, and now I think we're ready to pour the stuff on. Now, let's see. Did I remember to add the salt? I'm not sure I remembered to add the salt.
I don't think you did.
Yeah, there's like making pie and doing an interview at the same time. We'll see if I can pull this off.
Yeah, that's right. If the pie's bad, it's my fault.
Okay, so now we did put sugar, we put butter, we put eggs, right?
No, I did put the
salt.
Three eggs.
Okay.
We've got the vanilla in.
We've got the vanilla in.
We did the rhubarb.
Definitely did the rhubarb. We wouldn't forget that. That would be real obvious. All right. Now I'm going to get this in the oven. Thanks so much, girls. You can lick that bowl. All right.
1 hour. And by the time we're done talking, the pie will be done.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and we're in Seldovia today on Kachemak Bay talking with Aaron McKittrick, whose new book is Mudflats and Fish Camps. It's from Mountaineers Books. And it tells the story of her journey around Cook Inlet, walking the beaches, paddling where they couldn't walk, with her husband, Hig, and two kids, one a four-year-old who was on foot and one who was being carried. And I wanted to talk in this part a little bit about just the adventure of taking kids on fairly strenuous wilderness expeditions. And Aaron, I think, has done that more than anyone else I've ever heard of. And so while we not all parents are planning to do that sort of thing, there's probably a lot we can learn about it. And Aaron, I'm curious as to what you think are sort of the most important lessons. I mean, I would just, my guess would be that attitude and sort of how to project a positive attitude would be really a starter. But I mean, you tell me, what are the biggest lessons and things, tips you can give to other parents?
Well, yeah, I mean, and to be a little bit more specific from attitude, I would say patience and imagination both are pretty key. Patience because, well, kids always require patience, and kids are, they're really slow sometimes, like really, really slow. And, you know, you can't always just yell at them to go faster, or perhaps you can, but over the long term, the strategy is not going to be real effective in getting you a good hiking partner. And so, and that's really hard. I mean, it's hard to walk at the speed of a four-year-old or a three-year-old. And you know, it's just...
And you and Hig are already really experienced outdoors people and really fit, right? So you want to move because that feels good.
Yeah, you do want to go faster. And, you know, partly mixing it up with paddling is great because you get to, you know, the kids can rest and you can paddle quickly if you feel like it. But, you know, you kind of are, you know, part of that patience is your... You know, you're training a partner for you. You're training, you know, a hiking partner. You're training, you know, and you're meeting them where they're at.
And here comes one right now. So doing that deal where you don't go too far, you don't push too hard. On the other hand, I mean, maybe you've gotten problems with your kids where they're pretty tough. When you're getting started, sometimes kids will sort of like not want to do anything, you know, and so there has to be a little encouragement.
Oh, I said patience. I didn't say not pushing. Uh-huh. There's a difference. I mean, we do sometimes do long days and things are hard. I think that, you know, you just have to, you know, embrace the kid's pace and encourage a little bit and a little bit and a little bit, because it actually doesn't mean that they do really short days, and often, especially as they've gotten older, they can do some pretty impressively long ones. But you do have to be patient with the speed and the attention, and especially for the really young, like preschool age kids, like that's really where they can start learning to be good travelers. But you know, they're not there yet.
Yeah.
And part of, you know, because you do have to push too, because part of it, another thing I think they can tell is they can they can read your own level of confidence. Like if you don't, if you're not sure they can make it, they won't make it. But if you're just like patient, being like, oh, I know you can make it to the top of that mountain. Mm-hmm. We'll take as long as you need. I know you can. And if you really believe it, if you really believe like, oh, okay, you know, my kid can do this, they know, they'll pick up on that. And I think a lot of kids who have the most trouble are when their parents aren't comfortable and the kids can pick up on it. They think, oh, my mom or dad isn't comfortable in this situation and thinks it might, worries it might be too hard. Mm-hmm. So now I'm going to say it's too hard, and it's self-fulfilling.
Yeah. What about the evening routine? Do you have things that you do when setting up camp or choosing where you're going to camp to make it like homey or anything? Or what do you have, like, sometimes kids are really into routine, right? And you're sort of doing something that's not routine because it's sort of like out there new all the time.
But it is routine. Like, it's just, you don't think of it that way because, you know, it's maybe not an ordinary routine in modern life, but like actually in a way for a kid, it's way more stripped down and simple than like most of our modern lives. It's like, okay, what are you doing today? You're going to wake up, you're going to pack up the tent, you're going to walk somewhere with your mom and dad, you're going to set up the tent, you're going to cook your dinner, and you're going to go to sleep. And like the tent is home. And actually, you don't have your mom and dad rushing 20 different ways and having meetings and whatever. And it's actually, you know, strangely, I almost think it's somewhat more routine. Like, you don't have to worry about what day of the week it is or who's supposed to be somewhere when. Just all of us need to make progress in that direction.
Yeah.
And the tent.
Life is simplified.
Yeah, life is simplified. The tent is home. It is routine. And, you know, there's certain things. Sure, we like have little note. I always write every night, and so the kids have their own little notebooks, and they'll, you know, draw pictures mm-hmm. or whatever in the tent in the evening.
So at what age did you first introduce your kids to trips? I mean, what was the youngest you've taken a kid out?
8 months. For if you, by taken out, you mean like, I mean, what I would consider an expedition, which is something at least a month long. Like, I mean, they were hiking from newborn, but the first expedition we did with a very young kid was when my daughter was 8 months old, and we spent 2 months on Malaspina Glacier.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious as to if you've, I mean, as a parent, I know I learned most of what I learned through trial and error. And making lots and lots of mistakes in lots of different ways. None of them, I guess they all turned out all right. You know, the kids are still around. Any, like, mistakes or things you learned that you didn't expect in taking kids on these kinds of expeditions or just discoveries that you, you know, that came to you or, you know, incidents that sort of were instructive?
I mean, we make mistakes like any parent all the time. I think that with younger kids, I mean, I did learn that they needed, you know, more time like at a campsite than I would have initially liked. So, you know, we did do a little bit more base camping with them, including places like on Malaspina Glacier, where we would base camp for like 5 days and then move the toddler and the baby. I guess one thing you have to learn is like, okay, what is the intersection of things adults find fun and things that kids of whatever age find fun? And so when they were really little, we realized that, oh, instead of like trying to move everybody every day, we did more half base camp trips, or we'd set up camp for like 5 days in one spot, and then it would be a huge pain to move everybody to the next spot, but then we'd hang out for, you know, 5 days there and repeat the process. Another thing, and we love it too, is we spent a lot of time on coastlines because they allow us to mix up the mode of transportation. We can paddle sometimes, lets us make a little better time. The kids get a rest, and also kids love to play on the beach. All kids I've ever seen love to play on the beach. And so we can be a place that's interesting to us that the kids also love. Whereas some things like any sort of bushwhack, if you're much smaller and can't see over anything and can't push past anything, are a lot harder. So not that adults don't love bushwhacks either, but, you know, there's certain things, the balance of what you choose has to be different because it has to work for everyone.
Uh-huh. And so it takes a little while of just gauging how your kids are feeling and trying something different when it's not working and being a little bit flexible, I guess.
Yeah, and another thing is you learn from them, too. Like, I learned to be patient with them. And then I would say another really important quality is imagination. And it's more something I learn from them. Because there have been times that the kids have taught me to appreciate parts of the wilderness that seem... Okay, I'll come in a second. There's times the kids have... I heard. I'm going to finish my sentence, then I'm going to come in. There are times the kids have taught me to appreciate parts of the wilderness that might seem on the surface more boring. Like there was a time we were, skiing up on the Seward Peninsula. It was between Wales and Shishmaref, and it was white. It was flat. It was white. I mean, basically, it was cloudy, and it was like flat and white and cloudy. And you'd like look into the distance and think, I see a little black spot. Might be a cabin. Might be a bit of driftwood. I'm going to ski towards that little black spot for miles. But because the kids, they have such a capacity to be imaginative, like that doesn't bother them. They don't get, they don't think, oh, the landscape hasn't been changing as much just lately, and so this is boring. They're totally engaged in like their pretend game where they think they're like hunting for Easter eggs and melt holes or whatever they're doing. And then you got to take something from them, like, okay, don't be so, impatient adults, wanting the external world to like satisfy you. You've got to, be comfortable in your imagination too.
Yeah, good tip. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and I'm with Erin McKittrick. Her new book is Mudflats and Fish Camps, and we're at her home at a yurt near Seldovia. The kids who accompany Erin, her husband Hig, on all these expeditions are here. And after having done this 800-mile journey on foot and pack raft around Cook Inlet, I feel like you must have... it must have come to some conclusions about the environmental status of the inlet and sort of how the inlet is changing, and the decisions we're making about it. And for most of us, I think we, see news about the belugas and the fact that belugas are endangered and sort of wonder, well, what does that mean exactly? How can that be fixed? But you've got a much finer grained feel for the place, and I'm wondering what your impression was in terms of, like, what's the status of Cook Inlet from an environmental, ecological standpoint?
Maybe we should wait for the plane.
That goes with it. I mean, planes are all around Cook Inlet all the time, right?
Yeah, planes are all around all the time. I mean, it's interesting because you can definitely paint a very different picture depending on who you talk to and how you're going to look back. I mean, I know that, for instance, in Kachemak Bay, you can go out and you can look and just like, look how amazing this place is. And, I can watch the whales and I can, see all this wildlife. And then you can, especially because I've only, lived here for less than a decade, you can talk to people who've been here longer and say, oh, yeah, and there used to be, crabs, and there used to be this kind of bird, and there used to be all these things that maybe we don't miss if we didn't know them. And so, the Alaska has a pretty high turnover rate of people coming and going, and so... I think there's a lot of parts of the state where we're missing that sense of what stuff used to be like, and
it's a shifting baseline, right? So whatever was there when you got there is all that's supposed to be there. But maybe in your grandfather's time, it was quite different.
Right. And, you know, there are certain communities where people's grandfathers were here, and, you know, a lot of the Native communities especially. But, you know, because there's been, you know, so much population growth, and I think Alaska has the highest rate of people moving in and out of just about any other state, a lot of us don't have that baseline at all.
Yeah. So you were out there kind of setting a new baseline for yourself, but also talking to people from around the inlet, right? And a lot of Native people, and people have been there quite a while. What kind of things did you hear from them?
I mean, especially, you know, I think that the folks up in Tyonek were probably, you know, the most, you know, pessimistic, I think, the most places I talked to in terms of the changes they'd seen. I mean, they pretty much kind of thought, like, yeah, you know, we've seen people come and we've seen these changes, and that basically it hasn't been good. Like, they, you know, things haven't been, they haven't changed in a good direction. But then, of course, you know, there's different things that have changed in a good direction for people. I mean, you also hear, like, we talked to a guy in Soldotna who was like, yeah, this used to be nothing and there was no work. And then, you know, once the, you know, oil started getting going, now, you know, now look at this. We have all these people, we have all these jobs. And so you, people can look at the same change in two very different ways.
Yeah. So what about the impact of the oil industry when you are out there in the remote parts of Cook Inlet? A lot of it's pretty big and evident, I would think, but I'm not sure. And there's some of it that probably those of us from Anchorage have never even seen. So did you see some industrial stuff that was surprising, or that, like, was, you know, did that impact the view shed and sort of impact you when you were out there?
I mean, we certainly saw, you know, all the platforms in the inlet and things like that. And I think that, and maybe this is, I used to be a scientist, and so I can't help, you know, sometimes talking in that. We need to separate noticeability from impact, because saying that I can see the oil platforms is clearly obvious, which is not to say that those, what specific problems those platforms may or may not be causing. And so we can easily forget the difference between. Mm-hmm. And so some of the specific things, you know, actually one really good thing that's happened is the plan to close the Drift River facility, which doesn't.
And this is a terminal on the west side of Cook Inlet where I guess oil was stored and transshipped and loaded on tankers, and people have been concerned for a long time that it was kind of in a floodplain. So then that's recently been announced to be, it's going to be removed.
Yeah, and it's not just a floodplain. Where it is it's at the base of a very active volcano in the path of volcanic eruption caused mudslides, and has been almost, you know, destroyed by volcanic eruptions several times in the past. And of course, when they first put it, maybe they didn't quite know, but it was like basically almost as soon as they put it up, it was almost destroyed. And that's happened another couple times. And, you know, even, you know, separating out what you might think of the industry as a broader thing, like, maybe you shouldn't put the oil right where it might spill when the next time the volcano erupts. And so there's, like, you know, even it's maybe a, you know, maybe that's a small thing, maybe not, but it's a pretty important thing, I think. And so there's things like that. And then overall, though, you know, part of the thing about oil is that it's almost like what you're looking at is hard to measure, because it's usually you're looking at the chance of a disaster. Because day-to-day operations, you know, they have, you know, the oil gets produced and the oil gets burned and it has global climate change impacts. But day-to-day operations aren't necessarily going to be doing too much other than that. The you know, the things are going to be working as they should. It's when they don't. And when we had that, you know, gas leak earlier, or when you have some kind of volcanic eruption, or when you have a big spill. And so it's hard to measure that, because you're trying to measure the chance of something really bad happening, but it's not something that's easy to tease out.
Yeah. Well, and the climate change impact is one that it's hard to even figure out where it's coming from, right? Because it's coming from our tailpipes. It's also coming from oil fields. And where it's going is always really hard to selectively attribute, because climate is not an event, you know, it's a broad average of events. So, I mean, that's part of it, right? I mean,
yes. I mean, basically, I can pretty confidently say, yes, climate change overall is a big problem, and all uses of petroleum products and all production of them contribute to it. But you can't, of course, you can't pin, you know, this or that on this or that specific facility.
And when you get out there and you're doing an expedition like this, it sort of the inability to make easy answers, I guess, probably becomes more and more clear.
You know, maybe that's why I write books instead of becoming a politician and writing slogans, because I don't think the world has one sentence answers. You know, about good or bad things. I mean, maybe I put the Drift River Terminal as one of the first things I said, because it's, I think, a more clear-cut case than most things. And most things, there's not a clear-cut answer about, you know, sometimes not about what's gone wrong, or sometimes just not about what you might do about it.
So tell me, you're planning to do some trail building this summer. Do you have any more goals in terms of big expeditions that you're dreaming of or that you're planning, that on the same scale as this one and some of the other amazing ones you've done?
Always, but actually we're going to take a step out of our comfort zone, which is always a good thing for an adventurer. And before we do another big expedition in Alaska, we're actually planning to take our family to South America for 9 months and step out of our cultural and language comfort zone and try to do some expeditions down there.
Where are you going to be going specifically?
Specifically, Peru, Bolivia, northern Chile, and more specifics than that are, you know, what I ought to be planning right now. I tend to procrastinate more and more on expedition planning the more and more expeditions I do, which is not necessarily a good thing.
So some high altitude stuff probably.
Yeah, probably some high altitude stuff. And we also, I'd love to see the coastal desert, so we'll go down there too. And I think it'll be very different from here, which should be interesting.
So, and other writing projects that you've got going?
I have like ideas I'm playing around with for future books, but not quite playing around with them to enough extent that I can talk about them yet. And otherwise, I've been doing shorter things, like things for the Dispatch and some other magazines.
Yeah. And the new book, give me the whole title because I can't remember the subtitle. Just to...
Mud Flats and Fish Camps, 800 Miles Around Alaska's Cook Inlet.
All right. And that's from Mountaineers Books. And the author is Aaron McKittrick, who I've been talking to today. Here in Saldovia. Thanks so much for being with us, Aaron, and good luck with the pie and with the potluck and with the children in South America and the trail building and everything else. You're so busy.
Thanks, and thanks for coming and tolerating my somewhat chaotic home for this interview.
Whose is it? Yeah, you're very brave to have me here to do a radio show. That's all for today's Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Eric Bork. Our assistant producer is Hannah Doro. My name's Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.